Forbes says the mined diamond industry is caught between a rock and a hard place. I'm not making that up myself. It's not my fault. That's because no matter how many changes companies make, mining for diamonds affects the environment. More diamond customers want to know where their gems are coming from, and they want them to be more sustainable. Cue the interest in diamonds created and hard-pressed in labs. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. And we're taking your calls about these jewels. Do you care where your diamonds come from or how they came to exist in the first place? What about the cost of diamond jewelry? And why do you care whether that stone is a diamond or some other material? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email if you prefer at ideas@wpr.org. Being a jeweler runs in Soha Javaharian's family. He's a 10th generation jeweler and also a gemologist, co-owns Soha Diamond Co. in Madison. Soha, thank you for being here on The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me.
Help us understand this difference and similarity between what a diamond is when it's mined and the lab-created variety. They're different, but they're not.
Sure. Great question. Yes. So lab-grown diamonds are in every way, you know, a real diamond. If you crystallize carbon, which is what diamonds are, they're one element. If you crystallize that carbon with heat and pressure, no matter where it took place, no matter how long it took place, it becomes diamond. The end result, that crystallization, is diamond. So lab-grown diamonds are in every way, chemically, physically, and optically, identical to their mined counterparts.
And do people that you talk with understand that, acknowledge it, or does it feel somehow less real?
I think the consumer perception is that it's possibly less real, maybe too good to be true. A lot of misconceptions about if they're real or similar or if they're an alternative, but they're in every way an actual diamond. So it does take quite a bit of education and maybe experience seeing them side by side with a mined diamond to actually see the benefits of it.
You work with clients who order jewelry that includes diamonds that are created in labs. What are they giving you for reasons that this is the preferred option for them?
Sure. I think it's a combination of reasons. Contributing factors would be they're ethical, they're moral, they're environmentally conscious. They're that diamond that everyone always wanted, but they just didn't know where it could come from. In that sense that you're not compromising anything by choosing lab-grown diamonds. And in fact, you're getting a better value. Your money goes further. You can save money, get a larger stone or a higher quality stone. Any of those combinations, based on the client's unique needs, we can accommodate with a lab-grown diamond.
And is that because the supply chain is just condensed? I mean, you don't have to go through as many people and processes to get it from, itself being a diamond to the client?
Oh, so surprisingly, the cost per carat of a rough diamond is very similar, I mean, within a few dollars, essentially, of a mined diamond that you were to extract from the ground. It's very labor-intensive, as you know. A million children still mine for gemstones and diamonds internationally. And with that information, I think it's heartbreaking. I think if a lot of people understood that and saw that, they would choose lab-grown diamonds more often. And I think that is changing over time. But yeah, it's a great question.
And I mean, we have kind of revered diamonds because of their rarity, because of the circumstances that are kind of unique that
sure.
create them. Where do they come from? Remind us of that, because I think
sure.
we know that they're rare, but we don't quite understand the circumstances under which they're created.
Sure. Yeah. So diamonds from the ground have basically come from miles beneath the earth with the weight of the entire world, essentially, and with temperatures that only the inner of the earth could create, and pressures associated with it have crystallized carbon. And over time, in fact, no one really knows how long a diamond grows for, but it can crystallize within, you know, a matter of a short amount of time, but it's trapped underground for millions of years. And so that romance, that rarity of that process, not necessarily the rarity of the diamond, is so unique. Nothing else is like it in nature. And really the heirloom qualities associated with a diamond. It's a benchmark on the Mohs scale of hardness. It's a 10. Its thermal conductive properties are amazing. Its heirloom quality, it, with proper care, not too much care, but just proper care and usage, it can look the same in 50 years or 100 years as the day you were proposed to.
And that's different than other gems.
Yes,
sure.
Every other gemstone is in some sense inferior gemologically, scientifically, in terms of properties, compared to a diamond. A diamond is truly a benchmark for its beauty, its fire, It's scintillation. It's brilliance. Nothing else looks like a diamond. If it does, it looks too good to be true, or it looks less lively, than a diamond.
Hmm. Soha Javaharian is a 10th generation jeweler, and we're talking about the fact that he sells diamonds grown in labs to his clients, what they're looking for, what it means to them. And you're part of this conversation. What questions do you have about diamonds themselves? Maybe you've purchased a lab-grown diamond before. Why did you choose that as the option? You can call 800-642-1234 and let us know what you think. Maybe you recently purchased a piece of jewelry with diamonds. Did you know where they came from? Give us a call at email us at ideas@wpr.org, or that number again is 800-642-1234. We talked a little bit about the cost of a lab-grown diamond. Is there an advantage, depending on the piece, to opting for one that is grown scientifically rather than naturally?
Sure. And that cost difference on the retail side, on the consumer side,
right,
is about 30% less expensive than a comparable mined diamond from the ground. And, that is not only the one important factor to consider, but also, we're talking about a stone that was not mined for. There's no impact, or very, very minimal impact in terms of environmental compared to a mine stone, which is very, intensive on mining and the earth. And you're quite literally moving tons of ore for 1 carat of cut and polished diamond. Whereas on the lab-grown front, you're just basically growing it in a controlled environment. Of course, you're using electricity. No one denies that. We're using it now as we speak here. So it's quite amazing.
Yeah, lab-grown diamonds, pretty new in comparison to the fact that you are 10th in a line of generations of jewelers. So how does this fit into that, the realm of jewelers and gemologists?
Sure. So I'm the first generation in my family to really offer lab-grown diamonds to the market. But lab-grown diamonds are not new themselves. General Electric, GE, first pioneered the process here in the United States in 1954. And since then, lab-grown diamonds were made generally for manufacturing, drilling, abrasives manufacturing internationally. And not until the last decade or two where the quality was brought to a level to be gem quality. And gem quality means that it just meets the criteria that's, subjective but beautiful in terms of quality for the four C's: the color, the clarity, the cut, and the carat weight associated with fine jewelry.
And so you saw them and thought, this is the direction I'll take things.
Well, I learned about them, and I kept asking questions in my previous experiences and education, and no one could tell me anything bad about them. And I thought, well, why aren't more people choosing lab-grown diamonds? Why isn't there more conversation about lab-grown diamonds? And I think as an industry, a lot of people are shy, and they just want to continue telling the story of a mined diamond and the romance of that. But consumers are demanding more transparency, more ethics, more, transparency in terms of environmental impact.
I have to ask, did you get any guff from your family?
I got support, but, I got some questions about, sure, are they real? And, some misconceptions that I had to address face-to-face with my own family.
Sure. People who have been doing this for decades and decades. We're talking with gemologist Soha Javaharian about lab-grown diamonds. They're becoming more popular, and they're a contributing factor in a dip in sales for traditional mined diamonds. What are your questions about diamonds? Do you own one that you know was grown in a lab? Or maybe you shopped for a sustainable diamond where you understood where it came from. Maybe you don't really know and you kind of regret that you didn't ask. 800-642-1234 is a number you can call. There's a line for you. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and it's The Morning Show. If you saw a flurry of engagement ring photos in these last couple of weeks, you are not alone. The holidays offer this sentimental opportunity to pop the question. And diamond engagement rings still the standard, and yet some couples are adding to their expectations when looking for the right rock. They want sustainable, environmentally friendly options. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with a Madison jeweler who's catering to that, selling diamonds that are grown in labs, not glass that looks like it's cut like a diamond, but real, scientifically identical diamonds. And we're taking your questions about diamonds and about other gems, how diamonds in grown in labs stack up against those mined from the earth. 800-642-1234 is a line for you. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Soha Javaharian, and he's a business owner, also a 10th generation jeweler. And Greg from Southeast Wisconsin wants to join our conversation. Greg, thanks for being here.
Yeah, just real briefly. I make my own jewelry kind of as a hobby. And I started to source lab-grown white sapphire as a substitute for diamonds in something that's that where I want that kind of brilliance. I was wondering about your guest's experience using that as a further substitute, being that a sapphire is next in line to diamond on the Mohs scale. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Greg, thanks so much for the call. What do you think, Soha?
Yeah, great question, Greg. So as you know, a white sapphire, the species is corundum, which is the same as a ruby or a sapphire. So it's the same family and classification for gemological properties. And it is a 9 on the Mohs scale of hardness, but the Mohs scale of hardness is not linear by any means. So a 9 on the scale is, much harder than an 8, 7, 6, but it's exponentially not as hard as a 10, a diamond. So a diamond is multiple times harder and therefore more heirloom quality than even a white sapphire. The refractive index of diamond, slowing light entering the actual diamond material, makes it less brilliant as opposed to, white sapphire is not as brilliant, won't show as much fire. But you're right, it does look like a diamond at a glance. But upon further inspection, the faceting, the hardness, the luster will not be the same as a diamond.
And Soha, you have some pretty extensive training and some of it through the Gemological Institute of America. I mean, how do you figure out all of these different pieces and know that and communicate it to clients?
Sure. So it's balancing the technical gemological kind of jargon with, everyday consumers and shoppers who are really well-educated and well-researched when they come to the table and talk to us about fine jewelry. So my experience, I'm a graduate gemologist, went to GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, out in Carlsbad, California. Very fortunate I received a scholarship to become a gemologist. And after that, I worked at Tiffany & Company and also at GIA itself as a diamond grader. So my experience is quite vast in the sense of behind the scenes, retail, industry grading. It's quite amazing that lab-grown diamonds kind of meet all the criteria and exceed them in a lot of ways for many consumers.
And why do you think that that customers need someone who has a variety of experiences and a depth of knowledge when they're purchasing something? What's at stake?
What's at stake is just reassurance, transparency, in that you're talking to someone, whether it's a retailer or an online jeweler, who can back up their knowledge with experience. It's not just a preference or it's not a biased opinion. We talk facts, we talk figures, we talk gemological properties that drive conversations towards impactful decisions and expensive decisions. We don't discount the fact that these are expensive, several $1,000 decisions that people make very infrequently, really once in a lifetime. So we as jewelers, my wife and I, take very seriously that conversation with our clients.
Soha Javaharian is a jeweler, also a gemologist, and we're talking about diamonds that are grown in labs, some of which he sells to his clients. Matt from Lodi is here with a question. Matt, what are you wondering?
Yeah, I was just interested. You mentioned a little while ago something about 1 million children that are helping mine that are mining for diamonds. And one thing, obviously in America, we hear that and we think that's tragic, but is this a form of livelihood for them? And if we remove that from them, which is as unfortunate as it is, are we actually just creating another problem, creating more poverty, perhaps?
Matt, thank you for that question. The question of sustainability is really complicated, Soha.
Sure. It really is. Matt, great question. Just to clarify, the 1 million children mining aren't just for diamonds. They're both for diamonds and gemstones globally. And a lot of that is backbreaking work. It's unfair labor practices. It's unregulated. And associated with to answer your question, lab-grown diamonds, I don't envision taking the place in the short term 100% of the mine industry. It's really complementary, and it's a subsector of the diamond industry. I wouldn't be here speaking to you today, Keely, without mined diamonds. I wouldn't be a 10th-generation jeweler without the history of diamonds and the aura of those diamonds. So we do appreciate all the work internationally everyone's done. But, you know, I can't really answer that question.
Sure, right. It may be, you know, part of the equation, and that's on the individual then to decide what makes sense for them when they're investing in a piece like this. We now have Chris from Central Wisconsin who wants to join the conversation. Chris, thanks for calling the morning show.
You're welcome. Let me just through my phone is, okay. Yes, I have a question. Hello?
Yes, we're here, Chris. What's your question?
Yes, okay. I have two questions. One is Mr. Sohai able to tell the difference under a microscope if he had two diamonds sitting there, if one was manufactured and one was not? And the second has to do with the value or the perceived value of a diamond if it can be manufactured. Does that negate the rarity of a diamond? Can these be manufactured, like a ton of them at a time? Or, you know, all of a sudden you're flooded the market with diamonds, that would decrease the rarity and the value then.
Ooh, Chris is taking us into the economics of it, too. Good questions there, though. So, how? What do you think?
Sure, Chris. Thanks for asking that question. In terms of the difference side by side from a mined diamond and a comparable lab-grown diamond, no trained jeweler or gemologist, even myself who's worked at a diamond grading laboratory, couldn't tell a difference diagnostically. I'd be lying to you. Anyone would be lying to you if they told you one looks lab-grown and one looks mined. Now, there could be indications under higher power magnification with a binocular microscope. Those are tools that jewelers and gemologists may have on site to see a difference. But to answer your question, diagnostically, no, absolutely not. Indication-wise, maybe with inclusions or and that's becoming more and more difficult to do as well. So generally, no, absolutely not. You can't tell a difference side by side.
And Chris's other question is, can we just make a bunch of diamonds then?
So making diamonds is very capital intensive. It happens internationally, all over the world, even here in the United States. There are two processes in which you can grow a diamond. One's called high pressure, high temperature, HPHT. The other one is called CVD, chemical vapor deposition. They're both very technical. They both require seed crystal, which many people don't know, of a diamond. So you have a sliver of a diamond that you use to actually grow diamond on top of, either upward or outward, and so on. So the post-production of that, I think one of your questions, Keely, before was, what happens after that? Well, once you grow a diamond, all the post-production is the same as a mined diamond. They're both rough. They're both somewhat ugly, in all honesty. If you saw one, you wouldn't recognize it to be a diamond. It'd be brown, yellow, included. So you have to do a lot of planning to cut, facet, polish, and by a third party, grade that stone to then finally bring it to a retailer to show to a client.
Fascinating. And let's bring one more caller into the conversation. Elizabeth from Eau Claire is here. Elizabeth, what are you wondering this morning? Hey, Elizabeth, are you there? All right, we may have lost Elizabeth, but Elizabeth's question is, if a big retail jeweler sells mined diamonds and says they're conflict-free, can I trust that? That's a good question.
Great question, Elizabeth. Well, I'll define for you. The Kimberley process, which is a certification scheme in 2003, was created globally to combat conflict diamonds and therefore make them certified conflict-free. The industry will tell you that 99.8% of all diamonds that are mined are conflict-free, but I think a lot of people think conflict-free means it's perfect. It's moral, it's ethical, no children mined for it, you know, no blood was shed. But I'll define for you and read it straight from the Kimberley Process website, how Kimberley Process, KP, they abbreviate it, defines conflict diamonds as, and I quote, rough diamonds used to finance wars against governments around the world. So that definition is noble. It's amazing. I'm thankful for it. I think at that time it was revolutionary to do in 2003. It's almost 20 years later, and we're at a point where consumers demand and expect more transparency, and that definition is too narrow. That doesn't mean children didn't mine for it. It doesn't mean it wasn't backbreaking work where people weren't fairly compensated. It talks nothing about environmental impact and resources used to mine for those stones and all the money and bloodshed associated with that business. So, you know, can you trust the retailer? I would hope you could, but in our experience, when you get a mined diamond in, it doesn't come with that actual certification. It's for rough stones. So you're taking the word of your vendor, of your wholesaler, of the mining company. You know, the jeweler did not mine for that stone, and I did not grow that in a lab. But growing diamonds in a lab does guarantee the origin and the conflict-free nature of it.
Soha, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Soha Javaharian is a 10th generation jeweler. He's trained from the Gemological Institute of America and co-owns Soha Diamond Co. in Madison. Up next is news. Then WPR sports reporter joins the program to recap yesterday's back and forth Rose Bowl. Megan Hart is in California. The Wisconsin Badgers lost to Oregon by just 1 point. They scored 27. The Ducks scored 28. More details in a few moments. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. The Wisconsin Badgers lost last night's Rose Bowl by just 1 point. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Two captivating moments during the Rose Bowl happened during kicking plays that are normally pretty routine. Late in the game, the Ducks scored after the Badgers punter fumbled the ball. And earlier, Badgers sophomore Aaron Cruikshank returned a Ducks kickoff 95 yards for a touchdown. That was ESPN broadcasters calling the play. It's time for you to weigh in. Did you watch yesterday's game? What were your favorite moments? Tell us about being a Badgers fan. What do you think of their performance at the Rose Bowl and throughout the season? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Megan Hart is a sports reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, joining us from the West Coast, where she's covering the Badgers. Megan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You were at this game last night. Tell us about the atmosphere.
Oh, it was really exciting. Really, all week, downtown LA has just been full of Badgers fans. But yesterday in Pasadena, it was a great place to be. I would say it was actually probably split about 50-50 between Wisconsin and Oregon fans, and people just had a great time. Of course, you know, the outcome wasn't what Badgers fans wanted, but they really made it a lot of fun. They played jump around in the third quarter and people just went wild. So it was a great atmosphere.
You know, a great atmosphere that comes with a lot of pressure. I mean, the Badgers haven't won a Rose Bowl in nearly 20 years. What moments proved pivotal in that loss yesterday?
Yeah, it was a lot of pressure, and I imagine pretty stressful on fans with all those momentum changes, but it really kept them engaged in the game, which was a lot of fun. But there were some really good moments for the Badgers. That Cruikshank kickoff return was only the third in Rose Bowl history, and it's a game that's been played for 106 years, so that was a big moment. The Badgers, Jack Sanborn, linebacker, he had an interception on Oregon quarterback Justin Herbert, who's only thrown a handful of interceptions all season. Wisconsin had a few big fourth down conversions. So they had some really fun moments, but really it turned out that the most significant plays ended up being some of their mistakes. They had a lot of penalty trouble and they had four turnovers, and that's not easy to overcome.
Yeah, anytime four times in a game you give the other team the ball, not a good thing.
No, definitely not. They had three fumbles and one interception. And after the game, running back Jonathan Taylor, who has just been such an important part of this Badgers team for the last 3 years, he acknowledged that you really can't expect to beat a team like Oregon when you make mistakes like that. So they really kind of dug themselves a hole there. And it's also worth noting they missed a 47-yard field goal in the first half, which, you know, that's a big play when it ends up being a 1 point game.
Right. Because they could have, in theory, had those 3 points and still been able to keep ahead of Oregon. Mm-hmm. You know, the Badgers had a chance to come back about 4 minutes left in the game, but that stopped because they had a penalty called against the Badgers. And we should say some fans skeptical of that call. But penalties really were a problem for the Badgers last night, right?
Yeah, I think actually in the post-game press conference, somebody asked Paul Christ about Badgers coach Paul Christ about that call, and he said he hadn't gotten an explanation on what happened there. Regardless, it was called and it stood. So penalties were a problem. Wisconsin had 9 penalties for almost 80 yards, which makes a big difference when Oregon only had 2. And Oregon did have a big penalty at the end of the first half, a big pass interference call that set Wisconsin up for a touchdown going into halftime. But really, when you take 9 penalties, again, you're kind of got a lot to overcome.
We're talking with Megan Hart, who is WPR's sports reporter, and we're recapping last night's Rose Bowl loss, where the Badgers lost by just 1 point. And Jim from Cedarburg emailed us to say that they lost by 1 point. He says the coach lost the game when he didn't have them go for a 2-point conversion. Megan, what about coaching in this circumstance? Were there obvious missteps that happened in last night's game?
You know, I think he certainly has a point there. That 2-point conversion would have been a game changer. Paul Christ has proven, I think, during his time in Wisconsin that that he's a really quality coach. He's been in the program now for 5 years and the only first-time head coach to win more games in their first 5 years than Paul Christ is Urban Meyer. So he's a great coach, but, you know, that if they had gone for a 2-point conversion there, it certainly would have been a game changer.
Yeah, and watching the game from Wisconsin last night, I don't think you could accuse Coach Paul Christ of being anything less than passionate, especially as we saw the lead go back and forth between the two. Did you have a chance to hear from the coach at all?
Yeah, I did. After the game, he gave credit to Oregon, but he said kind of the same thing that was echoed by all the players I spoke to. Wisconsin made too many mistakes to overcome, and it's tough to win when you make mistakes like that. And he also said he was just really appreciative of the team and how hard they've worked this year.
Yeah, and when we are talking about the Badger players that you heard from, we also heard from Sanborn after the game. Here he is talking about Oregon quarterback Justin Herbert.
It's not the first game that he's ran with the ball, used his legs, and so, I mean, something we knew that he had.
You know, you have a Badger, you know, talking about a duck. Help us understand the relationship between players when they're on the field. We saw some really contentious moments that had to be broken up, but also, you know, a little bit of camaraderie after the game, even when the Badgers had a disappointing loss.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that at least on Wisconsin's side, they seem to recognize that, you know, they hurt themselves in this game. And Oregon and Wisconsin, they played in the 2012 Rose Bowl. Oregon won, but that's the last time that these two teams faced each other. So these players haven't played each other before, you know, being on opposite ends of the country. They don't see each other a lot, but in the Rose Bowl, it's a big game and the players took it very seriously. And so that's, I think, why it got heated during the game. But, you know, everyone that I spoke to after the game, regardless of the outcome, said that they had just had a really good experience here in California. They learned a lot from playing in the Rose Bowl. And so I think after the game, some of that camaraderie was just, you know, them recognizing each other's accomplishments because both teams did have a good season.
Yeah. How should we kind of gauge the performance of the Badgers offense overall last night? Did they show up?
Yeah, actually, the offense had some big plays. They had more rushing, passing and passing yards than Oregon. They also had more first downs. So it wasn't really a problem in terms of moving the ball. Again, it was really just the mistakes, you know, to have 3 fumbles and 1 interception. You are really setting yourself back doing that. They also had some penalties on the offensive side. They had a few holding and false start calls, as well as that offensive pass interference. So moving the ball wasn't a problem so much as kind of overcoming those mistakes.
How about the Badgers defense? What's the takeaway after last night then?
Well, the defense played pretty well in a lot of ways. They held Oregon to 204 yards, which is actually the fewest yards that Oregon had all season. Just as a frame of reference, they had 432 against Utah in the Pac-12 championship. So they have a good offense, and to hold them to just around 200 yards is pretty impressive. They struggled with stopping Justin Herbert on the run, and he's a great quarterback. He's expected to be an early pick in the 2020 NFL draft, but I'm not sure that anyone expected him to have three rushing touchdowns in last night's game, and that included that 30-yard go-ahead touchdown that put Oregon ahead at the end of the game. And Sanborn said it really just kind of came down to some miscommunications and poor angles by Wisconsin's defense in terms of stopping Herbert. But Herbert didn't have a lot of big passing plays. Wisconsin had a couple of sacks for losses last night. And that's kind of one of the things that they've been known for this season. They had 51 sacks on the season, which is the most in school history.
Last night's game, Megan had six lead changes. Makes for an exciting game, a somewhat stressful game. What was that like for you and the fans to watch?
It was a little stressful. I think one of the nice things about a game that close is it really keeps both of the fan bases in the game. Nobody gets too discouraged because there's so many different momentum shifts. So it made for a really fun atmosphere, but I can only imagine watching it at home. If you're a big Badgers fan, it's got to be a really stressful experience.
Right. There was a lot at stake. And so a lot of highs and lows when trying to work through it. Do we have any idea how many Badgers fans showed up at the Rose Bowl?
I'm not sure exactly. The official attendance was just over 90,000, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of red. Like I said, I would say it was about 50-50, give or take, between the two fans, which I think is really great that Wisconsin fans travel so well. They've had such a good run over the last 10 years. This was their fourth Rose Bowl appearance in 10 years, and their sixth New Year's Six Bowl appearance. So you imagine, fans maybe get tired of making those trips, but they really showed up. Pretty soon, Wisconsin fans are going to have to start getting apartments in Pasadena to come out for this game.
Suit up, wear your red, get in the car, hop on the plane, get out there. WPR's own sports reporter Megan Hart is talking with us about the Badgers after their appearance in the Rose Bowl last night. If you couldn't catch it, the Oregon Ducks defeated Wisconsin by a score of 28-27. But the infamous jump around streamed through the speakers. The only difference is that it happened halfway through the game and, well, Oregon fans didn't really want to participate in that Wisconsin tradition. Did you watch the game? Are you a Badger fan? What do you think about this season and how last night's game wound up? Are you proud of your team? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network, and I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and this conversation is all about the University of Wisconsin Badgers. WPR's sports reporter Megan Hart is reporting from the Rose Bowl. You've heard her stories this week, and now she's recapping her experience with us before she leaves California. And you can get in on this conversation about UW football, the number to call, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Megan, let's go into a quick rundown of a couple of the players that we saw last night. We should acknowledge just before the season started, we weren't sure whether the Badgers would have wide receiver Quintus Cephas. He faced sexual assault charges, then he was acquitted, then he was readmitted to the university and the team roster. How important has he been to the team's success this season?
Yeah, Cephas has been a big part of the team this year, and last night he had 59 yards and a touchdown. And I did get a chance to talk to him after the game, and he said, you know, it always feels good when the ball comes your way and you can make a difference for your team. And he was just trying to do everything he could for the guys in his locker room. But he's had a really good year for the Badgers. He has had more receiving yards this year than any Wisconsin player since Alex Erickson in 2015. So he's played an important role. And the Badgers have had a pretty good receiving core. For the first time in the history of the program, they had six players with 20 catches or more this year. So it's been a good year for Badgers receivers.
The Badgers don't have many seniors on the team, though. Much of the roster is freshmen and sophomores. Should we then, you know, expect the team to be better next year as those players gain experience?
That's a good question. When I talked to Cephas last night, he did say he thought that this experience at the Rose Bowl was going to be a really good learning experience for returning players. So, so those players who are coming back, they do have a lot of experience, and they have a lot of experience winning with this team. But Wisconsin is losing some key players. On the defensive side, Chris Orr and Zach Bond are both seniors, and they're two of Wisconsin's leading tacklers. So that'll be a tough loss. But the Badgers are also likely to lose some players, younger players, to the NFL draft, and that'll be very significant.
Very significant, because one of those would be Jonathan Taylor, right? You mentioned the star running back earlier.
Yeah, Taylor is expected to declare for the draft. They don't have to officially declare until sort of the middle of this month, and he hasn't done that yet. But I think all signs point to the fact that he's going to come out, and he's just done so much for this Wisconsin team. There's really so many things that you can say about them, about him as a player. He's won back-to-back Doak Walker Awards, which are given to the best running back in college football. And he just has some crazy records. One is this year he became the player, he set the record for most rushing yards by any college football player through their junior season. And he actually broke that record that was held by Herschel Walker with almost 250 fewer carries than Walker had. So he's just been such a big part of this team. And it's hard to say that a team without Jonathan Taylor could be better than a team with him.
We'll be paying attention certainly to how the roster shakes out, what happens as we move toward the next season of Badger football. Megan, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that Wisconsin's marching band performed at the Rose Bowl, a pep rally there. How did that go over?
Oh, yeah, the marching band was a big hit. They played at a pep rally Monday in downtown Los Angeles, which brought out a lot of Badgers fans, and people loved it. It was a really fun, I think, experience for fans. Melvin Gordon, former Badgers running back and current Los Angeles Ram, was there. The chancellor of UW-Wisconsin was there, and the band were kind of the star of the show. And then last night, actually, the band was really fun. They did, during halftime, a cool performance where they made an airplane, and they had like a smoke effect coming out of where the engines would be, and fans really liked that. So you know, the band were certainly popular last night too,
bringing some additional arts and culture from Wisconsin all the way to California. Megan, thank you so much for recapping it for us. Travel safely, and we appreciate you joining us.
Thanks.
Megan Hart is a sports reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. We've been talking about the fact that the Wisconsin Badgers lost last night's Rose Bowl by just 1 point. Now it will be time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is part of The Morning Show and the shows that you hear here on the Ideas Network. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with this story about a taxidermist.
Wisconsin's hunting season is underway. After the meat has been packed up in the freezer, taxidermists often take on the job of mounting the heads of the harvest. Amanda Bestuel of Iola is relatively new to the business and one of the few independently operating female taxidermists in the state. She told WPR's Patty Murray that mounting deer and other animals after they've been harvested is a respectful thing to do. Plus, it's part of some Wisconsinites' heritage.
Oh, hey. Hi, Amanda.
Amanda Bestuel greets me at her front door and leads me down to her basement workshop, which is well-ventilated and equipped with freezers.
I got into taxidermy
Basically because I've always had an interest in animals, and I was a fan of taxidermy. I enjoyed looking at it. And when I moved up here, I married into a hunting family.
Do you think you would have been into this business otherwise?
That's a good question. And not one I've really thought about, because this is where my life has brought me. But I think one way or another I would have gotten into taxidermy, mainly because it was always in the back of my mind. But there was a little bit of women don't do that. And I think that kind of squashed the idea for a long time until I grew up and got the confidence to just do it.
Bestel tans the hides of the animals, mostly deer. She has done everything from turkeys to a black squirrel and black bears.
To date, I would say my most challenging mount, I did a three-quarter bear, and it was most challenging because of its size and my size. It was a bit of a wrestle getting the hide onto the form.
Is there any animal you'd like to do you haven't done yet?
Gosh, there's so many I'd like to do. The next project I'm really excited about is to do my first bobcat, which I have in the freezer. It's ready to go, tanned. I just need to put it on the form in this freezer in here.
Bestel finds the cat's hide and pulls it out of her freezer that looks like it could be in any suburban basement.
You know what? The bobcat's right here.
Instead of a frozen pizza or chicken nuggets, she pulls out a bobcat pelt. Bestel and other taxidermists generally tan the hides of animals, then put them on a type of sculpted form similar to styrofoam. They add glass eyes to make the specimens look alive.
This was actually a roadkill bobcat that a customer picked up, and it was in good shape. That's another way to get specimens for taxidermy.
Bestel feels she's honoring the animals that have been killed. She also says most customers eat the meat.
Rarely do I buy any meat from the store that's been, you know, produced from factory farms and all that. It's, you know where your food's coming from, and I think that's important to a lot of people.
That story about taxidermist Amanda Bestjewel of Iola came to us from WPR's Patty Murray. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on all the social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum. And you also hear Wisconsin Life here on the Ideas Network. Tune in tomorrow morning during our Wisconsin Weekend program to hear another brand new Wisconsin Life. Coming up now on the morning show, we're discussing a push to declare racism a public health crisis in Wisconsin. And we're also looking at efforts to improve school safety through other means than just beefing up security, changing things like door locks and having metal detectors. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for being here on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.